supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Susan Phillips, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. After weeks of conversation and protest, Philadelphia has notified federal immigration officials it will stop sharing a real-time police arrest database. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports city officials allege the information was being misused.
Philadelphia told Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, that as of the end of August, the city will stop sharing data from the Preliminary Arraignment Reporting System, known as PARS. Solicitor Marcel Pratt says federal officials were using the information to go after residents not accused of anything other than being here without authorization.
ICE conceded that its use of PARS can result in immigration enforcement against otherwise law-abiding Philadelphia residents. Second, ICE claimed that it was impractical to adopt policies and procedures that would restrict its agents from using PARS to arrest law-abiding persons for civil immigration violations when ICE executes operations based on information found in PARS.
Miguel Andrade of the group Juntos says they've been fighting against the data sharing since the contract was first signed 10 years ago.
And it allowed for an essentially ICE owning up that they were doing racial profiling and collateral damage using this database. The use of it was immoral. They were using it to hunt down our community members, and this is a step in the right direction to making Philadelphia as a whole completely safe.
ICE officials declined an interview, but issued a statement saying they were disappointed with the city's decision, saying it, quote, needlessly compromises public safety, unquote. They insist ICE is using the database properly and promise they will continue to apprehend, quote, criminal aliens to uphold public safety in the city. Miriam Enriquez, director of the city's Office of Immigrant Affairs, says canceling the deal sends a clear message.
It's a decision that will once again reinforce to our immigrant communities that this city is not an extension of ICE. Witnesses and victims of crime in our city will know that they need not fear negative consequences when they report crimes to police or use services offered by the city.
Mayor Jim Kenney says he wanted to end the agreement sooner, but needed to do it in a way that would protect the city from losing federal funding.
It made me feel frustrated because I couldn't end it sooner, because we wanted to make sure that we had a strong legal position to stand on. I'm happy that we're able actually to announce it today. And I just want people to understand that I was always on their side. I mean, if I could abolish ICE, I would. But we can abolish this contract, and we are.
Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Consider how many things you've fought over with your family from the time you were a kid. Maybe wanting a new bike, new shoes, or fighting with your parents about how late you stayed out. Even as an adult, maybe disagreements over politics or a career choice. But then there's Megan Holleran, who says,
I've never fought with my family until this.
So before we get to the issue that made her fight with her parents for the first time, you need to know that Megan grew up in a rural part of Pennsylvania, a place called New Milford in Susquehanna County. Her family's land, 23 acres, bought by her grandparents in the 1950s, is about 2 miles up a dirt road, past fields and forests. And she's an archaeologist. It was back in the summer of 2012 when the family was preparing to turn the land into a maple tree farm. Some of the trees were more than 200 years old. At that time, Megan was working for a contractor surveying nearby land for a pipeline, and she got a call from one of her friends who had been at a party at her house that weekend. Megan told me the story about that day on the phone from Nevada, where she's now working on another archaeology project.
And they called me up and said, you know, hey, we're working at your house today. I'm pretty sure this is your place. We were all here for a party over the weekend. And I didn't really believe them. I thought that they must have had some sort of mistake, but it turns out that was true. And that was in spring, summer of 2012 was when we first found out about it.
Wow. So you were actually working as an archaeologist.
And yeah, that's a lot of what I do is work for things like pipelines and big contracts, construction jobs that are going to disturb the ground. They send us out first. And I happened to be working on that project when we found out it was going through my property.
Wow. That's kind of amazing. So why did they start working on your property without even telling you? Is that normal?
I mean, I guess they had sent out a letter that said, you know, Williams Corporation would like to do some surveys for an upcoming project on your property.
And that day, when Megan first found out there might be a gas pipeline coming through her family's land, that would turn out to be the root of the family's arguments to come. The pipeline builder, Williams, wanted to build a line they named the Constitution Pipeline through the Hallorans' burgeoning maple syrup farm. That was the first you heard that this actual pipeline was going through.
Yeah, it was the first that, you know, I went to my family after talking to my crew, my colleagues, and said, you know, this is a really big pipeline project, and I'm pretty sure we don't want it. Have you guys heard anything about it? And that was when my one aunt, who actually lives on the property, said, you know, I got a letter about something a while ago, but I didn't realize that this was what it was. And that was when we were able to start finally, you know, trying to look into it and figuring out, wait, what's going on here? What is this project? And we don't want it on our land.
And that was 2012.
Yeah.
That's 6 years ago. So this has been going on for a long time. Did they finally show up at your house and ask you to sign on the dotted line and offer you money?
Yeah, so eventually, you know, finally a land agent reached out and said, here's what the project is, here's the kind of right of way we want, and here's what we need from you to get permission. And at that point, they just said, you know, no, we don't think we want it. We could talk about maybe moving it somewhere else on the property, but ultimately those negotiations came down to just like, no, we don't want that here.
How much money did they offer you?
It was ridiculously low. So there was a really long period of time where there wasn't really any contact going on between my family and between Williams, because we just kind of thought that was the end of it. You know, we'd said no. We said we didn't want it.
So when did it rear its ugly head then?
Oh, man, I guess it was in the spring of 2014 when they really started pushing, we actually are going to put the pipeline here, and if you guys aren't going to allow us to, we're going to take it by eminent domain.
Okay, a few words about eminent domain. The Hallorans are just one family among hundreds across rural and increasingly suburban Pennsylvania who find themselves battling pipeline companies through eminent domain takings. And eminent domain is allowed when a project is determined by a court to be in the public's interest. But Megan says the pipeline does not serve the public good. She says the company wants to ship the gas overseas. But the company, Williams, says that's not where the gas would go. It's to serve residents of New York or New England, who often get stuck with big heating bills in the middle of winter. When the threat of eminent domain loomed over the family, that's when they learned about the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. And that's important to remember. It's a really important agency of the federal government. FERC has the power to decide if an interstate natural gas pipeline can be built.
Later on, we started filing all sorts of things with FERC as soon as we realized how that process works. And I don't know if you've ever tried to file anything with FERC, but it's not very intuitive, and it can be very complicated to do.
So this bureaucratic battle lasted several years and put stress on Megan, her parents, her aunts, and cousins, who all owned parts of the land.
We got into these high-stress situations of, you know, just everyone trying to figure out what the best thing to do is and no one really being sure, and, you know, all of us being pretty strong-willed.
In the meantime, they began buying equipment to start tapping their maple trees. But battling FERC just wasn't going so well.
Well, the difficult part about it is that it's really hard to figure out what you're supposed to do to fight it, right?
For pipelines, states have to weigh in on environmental permits. The company got what it needed from Pennsylvania, but it looked like New York was dragging its feet. The pipeline path runs 90 miles through New York State, close to the upper part of the Delaware River, and that foot dragging gave the Hallorin family some hope. The case got tied up in courts. Family members were debating whether or not to let the company on their land to survey. But a federal judge in Scranton stepped in and sided with the company.
The judge granted them their immediate access to the property. Granted them their eminent domain and said, you guys have immediate access. Just go ahead and do whatever you want.
The first thing the pipeline company wanted to do was cut the maple syrup trees. The Hallorans fought that. They argued that New York hadn't granted any permits yet. But FERC came down on the side of the company. Williams was working under a tight deadline to clear trees before migratory birds and bats returned in the spring. The trees had to go, and they had to go quickly. When crews showed up in February 2016, they were met with protesters, and so they backed off. The company then went back to court, and the court ordered the tree cutting to continue under armed guard. On March 1st, 2016, just as the Hollerins were preparing to tap their trees for maple syrup, the tree cutters returned.
Last time they were here, I gave them maple candy, and this time they returned with assault rifles.
That's right. Semi-automatic weapons defended the tree cutters from Megan and her family. About half a dozen federal marshals in bulletproof vests and helmets greeted them that morning. We traveled to the farm that day to report on the story.
Whether you're pro-pipeline, anti-pipeline, pro-gas, anti-gas, it doesn't really matter. You should be terrified by this situation.
Despite family arguments about what to do and when, the Hollerins remained united against the pipeline. They prepared for the destruction of their maple syrup farm by painting the trees with red, white, and blue stars and stripes. Megan and her family watched that day as 558 trees were cut.
They're taking about 90% of our maple trees on this property. So yes, all the potential we had to make maple syrup here on this property is being destroyed right now. We're devastated by this, but we're not going to leave. This is our home.
No money had exchanged hands, but here's how Megan described negotiations with the company.
The best way to quantify it is to think of it in terms of someone saying they're taking your land from you forever, and in response, they're offering you the price of a new truck.
But this story has a particularly devastating twist. It turns out the Hollerins were right about New York State. About a month after these trees were cleared, in a move that surprised everyone, FERC, the company, the courts, New York's environmental regulators refused to grant Williams water crossing permits for the Constitution pipeline. And today, 2 years later, despite the unceasing efforts of the pipeline company, it appears that the Constitution pipeline will never be built across the Hollerins land.
It's just been a lot of uncertainty and a lot of stress and just a lot of sleepless nights over something that, you know, it never needed to happen in the first place.
Right. What is the future look for? Like, what are the options going forward if they never build the pipeline?
We're hoping we get the possession of the land back and then, you know, go to court and try to determine what they have to pay us in damages, you know, just for not only to try to restore the land as best we can, but also just for, you know, having basically rented it for 6 years without ever paying any rent on it, you know?
So how does it look right now? I mean, what's going on on the land now?
It's a mess. Since they clear cut the trees, there's just this giant empty swath that, you know, used to be forested. And so it looks very bare and very stark.
The company, Williams, says it still plans to build the pipeline, but the Hollerins' attorney says that's unlikely. Still, if the company won't give the land back and FERC and the courts don't make them, those 5 acres of land running across the Hollerins' property will be owned by the company in perpetuity for them to do with it whatever they want, including selling it to another pipeline company. So this month, the Hollerins filed a lawsuit in federal court to get their land back and get compensated for the trees. Megan's mother, Catherine, told the court the ordeal took an enormous emotional toll on the family. In the meantime, Megan says they're still close. There may be less arguments now, but the land lies fallow. They can't legally use it for anything. Natural gas is in the international news this week as well. President Trump announced a trade deal with the European Union, and natural gas plays a significant part of that deal. The president wants Europe to buy more U.S. natural gas and less from Russia. Here to talk about that move is Bob Ineson. He's executive director of global LNG with IHS Market, which means he's a big expert in LNG exports. Bob, welcome to Newsworks Tonight. Thanks for coming on the show.
Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
What does this trade deal actually say about natural gas?
What it focuses on is the Trump administration is really desiring to change the physical balance of trade, and one of the things that we have in abundance that we can export is natural gas. And so it's a natural thing to focus on.
What are the odds that that's going to happen, that we're actually going to export more natural gas to Europe?
Well, it's been coming for a while. If you look at the shale boom, the consequence of it is that U.S. gas production is up on the order of 60% since 2008. The thing that is limiting U.S. gas production is available markets. So it's natural for the market to be trying to reach out and get into the broader global market where gas is less plentiful than it is here.
They're trying to reach out not just internationally, but also domestically, right? I mean, that's why we just heard earlier on the show a piece about pipelines. And that's why we have so many pipeline projects right now in the country, right?
The reason we have so many projects is the growth in supply has occurred in areas that were different than traditional, where the pipeline system had been designed to move gas from the Gulf Coast and then later from the Rocky Mountains into the Northeast. Now you have the Marcellus Shale and the Utica Shale in similar geographic area, and it's changed the center of gravity of production. So you have to redesign, reconfigure the pipeline system to accommodate it.
And I guess one question I think that everyone may have is right now the price of natural gas is really cheap, in part because of the Marcellus Shale. It's under $3 per BTU. But if these exports increase, if Trump's, you know, goal is met in terms of Europe buying more natural gas from the U.S. rather than Russia, what does that mean to us here? Will we start paying more on our gas bills?
We don't think so. The resource base is really quite large. And in our outlook, we have some pretty strong growth from where we are in U.S. LNG exports. With that, the resource base that we estimate is available for under $4 lasts beyond the end of our forecast horizon, which is 2040.
And so what does that mean for Pennsylvania? I mean, I know we have a number of pipeline projects in the works right now being built. Do you see more of that happening?
We do, but we expect the pace to slow. The Marcellus has gotten so big, and its footprint on the continent has gotten so big in terms of the area that it serves, that the pipeline capacity that's needed is getting to be progressively longer in distance. And we're rapidly approaching a point where you may need to build capacity out of the Marcellus all the way to the Gulf Coast. And that's an expensive proposition. But there's nothing in this picture that points to, say, a reversal anytime soon. You wouldn't expect Marcellus production to fall.
Well, thanks so much. Thanks again for taking the time to come on Newsworks Tonight.
Happy to do it, thank you very much.
That was Bob Ineson. He's the executive director of Global LNG for IHS Market, talking to us about natural gas exports. Another aspect of the United States trade deal with Europe is an agreement to hold off on new trade penalties. But members of Congress are already hearing from some constituents about how tariffs are taking a toll on their livelihood. Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller spoke with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll, about what the public thinks about the recent trade war.
Frank, do most Americans wish that we never went down this road?
Well, I don't think so, because when we ask Americans, just finished asking them, what impact have the tariffs had on you and on your job situation currently? 67% say no impact on my job for those that are working, and 72% say no impact on me personally. So a lot of Americans so far aren't seeing the kind of complaints that we're hearing from soybean farmers and other individuals like that. Although those who do say there's an impact are more likely to say it's hurting them than help them. And that's not an insignificant number. 17% and only 6% say that it's helping them. So it's a net negative. But a lot of Americans say, no, you know, life as usual, I don't perceive any significant impact. We did ask, however, Dave, long term, what impact do you think this tariff situation will have if it continues? Americans tilt towards saying, both for the U.S. economy and for their own personal financial situation, that this tariff situation is going to make things worse, not better. So however you look at the data, those who have an opinion are more negative than positive about all of the attempts to fix the tariff situation that we're seeing right now.
Frank, I understand Gallup is focusing on smoking habits in 2018.
We are. And there are a couple of patterns, big patterns, on what I call conventional cigarettes. And the reason I'm calling them conventional cigarettes is because we're now differentiating those from vaping or e-cigarettes, which I think is going to be very interesting to talk about. But in terms of conventional cigarettes, our data now down to 16% of Americans. This would be 18-plus Americans who say they've smoked a cigarette in the last week. We started asking that question in World War II after D-Day, November 1944. That's the first time we asked it, and it was 41%. Then it rose to 45%. In the mid-1950s, and that's as high as we've had it in our Gallup data. But as mentioned, we've been falling ever since, and we're now down to 16%, which is the lowest on record. And also the government data show the same thing. Fewer and fewer Americans are smoking. Dave, one of the most interesting patterns within those broad data is youth. I was talking to a smoking expert at the University of Michigan School of Public Health the other day, and he used the word plummeting, that the smoking rate among kids and among teenagers has been plummeting in this country.
So let's bring vaping back into the conversation. Are younger smokers, or those first trying it, taking up vaping rather than the traditional cigarette?
The evidence suggests that's the case. 9% of Americans say that they vape. And when you look at people 18 to 29, that's 20%, by far the biggest group of all.
Is there an increasing clamor to make tobacco use illegal?
Americans don't want anything made totally illegal. We see that when we ask about abortion. We see that when we ask about guns. And we see that for smoking. Although Americans clearly favor restrictions on smoking in public places and so forth, just about a quarter of Americans say that they think it should be made totally illegal in this country, kind of like prohibition back in the 19-teens and the 1920s. And I think part of that is practicality. Americans recognize that it's very difficult to outlaw something totally.
So an all-time low, 16% of respondents 18 and over smoked in the past week. I presume a much smaller subset of that cohort used either chewing tobacco or cigars or pipes.
Oh, absolutely. Those are very small numbers. When we say smoking a pipe, 1% of the population say they smoke a pipe regularly, another 3% occasionally. Cigars, 1% regularly, 8% occasionally. Chewing tobacco, 2% regularly, 3% occasionally. All those are very small numbers. And I should say, the percent of Americans who chew tobacco, smoke a pipe, or smoke cigars is also now lower than the percent who will tell us that they smoke marijuana. So a lot of things are replacing, particularly e-cigarettes and marijuana, these traditional uses of tobacco.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Okay. From trade wars to cigarettes, now we're going to take you inside a meat locker. This weekend marks the final days of a large-scale video installation about privacy laws and digital surveillance in Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood. Taking cues from recent Supreme Court rulings involving Fourth Amendment protections from unlawful searches and seizures, the show at the Crane Arts Building is called A Reasonable Expectation of Privacy. WHYY's Peter Crimmins takes us inside the exhibit.
The icebox at the Crane Arts Building is a big concrete space. It used to be cold storage. They stored meat in here once. And now it's an installation space. It's an art space. Right now, in the middle of it, is a public telephone booth. Old school. You don't really see these around much anymore. But you can walk inside of it like this, close the door behind you. And expect that perhaps whatever happens here is private. There, you can pick up the phone, and on there is a description of a privacy court case.
It was the first time when the Fourth Amendment was granted to someone having a conversation in a public space.
Artist Lisa Marie Patzer is talking about the 1967 Supreme Court case Katz versus United States. That's when the FBI recorded a man named Charles Katz placing illegal gambling bets from a public phone booth in Los Angeles. The Supreme Court overruled the conviction because it decided Katz had a reasonable right to privacy inside a phone booth.
That was a historically important moment in how the court applies the Fourth Amendment.
Inside the icebox, Patzer created something that feels like outside. It has a huge video projection, 75 feet wide, that tracks an actor playing Charles Katz as he walks through a neighborhood of row homes toward a phone booth, makes a call, and then walks away. And then two actors playing FBI agents dismantle a tape machine on top of the phone booth, The video projection is so large, the figures are life-size, and you can sit on a park bench and passively watch the whole scene. It feels like you're spying.
A lot of the justices asked questions like, what was the size of the phone booth? Did he have the door open or closed? Was he speaking in a low tone of voice? So they were really concerned about that perception of privacy.
As a new media artist, Patzer often uses electronic equipment very similar to surveillance technology. Another part of the exhibition invites visitors to text a password to a particular account, and in response, they will receive background information via text about other Supreme Court privacy decisions. But if you text her, Patzer collects metadata about you based on your text.
My goal in creating work like this is to have people really think about it a little bit more and just consider how their own activities are potentially suspect to invasion of privacy.
Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
And that's it for tonight's show. I'm Susan Phillips. Have a great weekend.